reside in the realm of mythology. What you are is a follower of Eusebius. It's in the gospel.
A reading from a letter of Pliny to Trajan about the Christians. This is what Christian apologists think the letter would have to say for it to be considered a forgery. Quote, "Dear Trajan, I caught your speech on TV the other night. Now, it's not my place to say it, but you performed admirably. I haven't felt that way during a monologue since I watched The Rock hosting SNL for the first time as a kid. My dear Majesty, many people still remember that sketch where The Rock came out with Chris Kattan dressed as a barbarian, just like the very same barbarians that you recently conquered in the Dacian Wars that ended in 106 AD. Now, I must admit that your last letter upset me somewhat. I will quote from the part that troubled me. You said, 'Pliny, I still can't believe you haven't seen The Goonies yet. It's one of those movies that you really have to see as a kid, and you missed out on it for some reason, but it's still a satisfying watch well into adulthood, and for that reason, I again urge you to view the landmark film.'" End quote. My Kaiser, I am well aware that The Goonies is your favorite film, and I would absolutely love to see it. The problem is, I haven't been able to, because you keep giving me too many assignments to complete here in my governorship of Northern Turkey. The most complicated assignment that's taking up all of my time is the one involving trials of Christians. Now, despite the fact that there have been probably about 975,000 obscure religious sects in the history of the Roman Empire from its very beginning to its end in the year 476, I mean, at least that's when I predict it's going to end. Despite the fact that you can throw a rock into any crowd on earth and hit a follower of some arcane, recondite local god that no one's ever heard of, I'm just going to throw out the term Christian to you with no explanation whatsoever and assume that you're automatically going to know exactly what I'm talking about. First of all, I don't even know what Christians believe or whether their beliefs are illegal in any way. But that being the case, I was basically killing the shit out of them without any semblance of due process until I finally decided to do an Ask Jeevus search to figure out more about their activities and customs. One of the results told me that Christians would never sacrifice to a pagan god, that is, a god from the religion that you and I practice, which is called Greco-Roman paganism. So I went ahead and seized one of them, a Christian belonging to the sect of the Millerites. I told him that he must perform a sacrifice to the moon goddess Luna, and he could go free. I did this despite the fact that everyone knows that the moon is not a goddess at all. In fact, it's a large natural satellite of Earth that's classified as a planetary mass object and differentiated rocky body. Yet, we still worship the moon because, according to Everett Ferguson, our religion is highly symbolic and much more focused on divine deeds and power than in divine personalities. I shared these enlightened ideas about the moon with the Christian while we were plugging in all the sacrifice equipment and getting it ready, but the foolish idiot started arguing with me, and he said that not only was there no such thing as the moon goddess Luna, but the physical moon itself isn't even real. He said that it's a simulation created by a reflector projected in the sky by global leaders who are trying to hide the planet Nibiru. My president, I'm telling you that at that moment, I wish I could have force-choked him like Darth Vader. As it was, I was ready to have him executed, but he pulled out his ID card that identified him as a Roman citizen. So as angry as I was, I followed the law by putting him in shackles and sending him on the next flight to Rome so he could make his appeal. Despite all that, the rest of the Christians were absolutely amazing people, and I've been having all kinds of fun learning about this strange new religion. For example, Did you know that there are over 100 million Bibles sold every year? In fact, I think that the Christians are so great that the Roman Empire should send each one of them an Obama phone with 100 anytime minutes, as well as a gift certificate for Build-A-Bear. Anyway, this letter is getting about as long as Infinite Jest, so I'll close with a line that made me think of you. You're not in my hands. It's why I see you often in my head. Peace out, my king. P.S. I'm sending you a link to one of my favorite Homestar Runner videos. I know, it's so 2002, but here in the Roman Empire of the 2nd century, the old ways are still the best ways. That was a reading of what Pliny's letter to Trajan would have to be for Christian apologists to be able to admit that it's a forgery. But might this letter that I just read not in fact be genuine? Let's approach it as a scholar would to see whether it's not in fact a real letter of Pliny. Well, first of all, Build-A-Bear, we might as well strike that as an interpolation, but they discuss Goonies. He says that the Goonies is the Emperor Trajan's favorite movie. Here's what I think. It seems like an anachronism, but maybe the oral traditions from which the Goonies is drawn go all the way back to the Roman Empire, and the Goonies film was really just borrowing from that ancient tradition. What else? He appears to reference modern scientific knowledge about the moon, such as would only be confirmed with the Apollo missions, but some ancient philosophers knew what the moon was. Anaxagoras said, "The sun and the moon and all the stars are fiery stones carried around by the rotation of the ether." And he's not far off from the 5th century BC there. He's actually more advanced in his views than even many Facebook users today. Pliny said he wanted to force choke the Christian like Darth Vader. I mean, we know that George Lucas pored over ancient myths to get materials for his stories, Joseph Campbell and all that. You know, presumably, lore about Darth Vader existed in Pliny's time. There could have been a historical Darth Vader for all we know. It had to be based on something, right? No one would just make it up. I mean, just like Jesus was a historical figure because the Gospel of John reports that he was hungry and ate a fish, and he got tired and had to sit down on a rock. Why would they write that if this was a book about a made-up divine man? In the same way, why would anyone write a scene where Darth Vader takes off his helmet in his little breathing chamber to reveal a sad, frail individual? It totally compromises his portrayal as this badass, evil dude. So there clearly had to be a historical Vader, and maybe Pliny was referencing him there. But for all that, I think that this letter reveals itself as spurious because in it, Pliny appears to reference my own favorite song, which is Videotapes by the band Blouse, and that was only released in 2011 AD, so I feel confident in declaring this writing to be late and fake. So we had a bit of fun there, but I wrote this parody because one of the main arguments for the authenticity of Pliny's letter to Trajan about the Christians is that the author says negative things about Christianity, something we can supposedly never imagine a Christian forger ever doing. And then they say that there's no other obvious indicators that it's inauthentic, such as style differences, anachronisms, and so on. I mean, that's what they say. It doesn't mean it's true, as we'll show over the next few weeks. But first of all, the letter does say positive things about Christians, but it's careful not to put these directly in the mouth of Pliny, at least not without a qualifier. Hence, Pliny tells us in his letter that it is said that no Christian would ever sacrifice to the traditional gods or to the emperor, and that no Christian would ever curse Christ. Pliny says in his letter, "I want you to understand that no one speaking by the Spirit of God says Jesus is accursed." Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry, that was Paul. Paul said that in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 3. I mean, the Pliny quote is just so similar to the Paul quote that I sometimes get them confused. You'll have to excuse me. What Pliny says is that none who are truly Christians can be compelled to curse Christ. I'm sure there's no relation between those two quotes. Pliny says in his letter that the lapsed Christians told him that they never committed any crime other than assembling at dawn and singing hymns and actually swearing never to commit a crime. Pliny says in his letter that the Christian religion is so potent, so influential in the region, that it's tanking the local economy because no one wants to buy sacrificial victims. Pliny says in his letter that the Christian religion is a danger to everyone of any age, rank, gender. I mean, in his telling, it's a danger. But to a Christian reading this, even today, it's evidence that they belong to a growing and popular faith. And by the way, Christian writers of the period, like Justin, Tertullian, often juxtapose those two concepts as well. Yes, the empire hates and persecutes Christians, but at the same time, Justin, in his book about persecution, brags that the Christians can be found among all races, all nations of men. The epistle to Diognetus says in this time that the Christians are scattered through all the cities of the world. Tertullian says, there's no nation which is not Christian. But this point about Pliny's dispraise of Christians, which we'll revisit in this series, is relatively minor. Of far greater concern is that the primary argument for the authenticity of this thing seems to be that it just doesn't seem like a forgery. Like the satire, the parody I came up with at the beginning, that seems like a forgery, and that's what they mean by that. You know, unless they're seeing a reference to Homestar Runner, then this thing, as far as they're concerned, is firmly 100s AD. Even Earl Doherty, who argues against a historical Jesus and gives some reasons to doubt the authenticity of the Pliny letter, seems to concede that it's genuine. He says, quote, "One wonders what a forger would think he was accomplishing by this type of fabrication." When this series is finished, maybe someone can send him a link to it. He'll have more answers to that question than he ever wanted. But on this subject of forgery, and whether forgery is easy and obvious to detect, I want to make it clear that detecting forgery in ancient writings is not so straightforward as it doesn't seem like a forgery, or there doesn't seem to be a reason why someone would do the forgery. And to that end, I'm going to read a brief letter by the tyrant Phalaris of Acragas. He was basically a warlord in Sicily in the 500s BC. It's his letter 51 to Etionikos. It's very short. Quote, "It's a wise saying indeed that you put into my head. Since all must die, so too should their anger. But suppose I followed your advice and could forget and forgive all my enemies and all they've done against me. Yet when it comes to that accursed Python, I neither can, nor will, nor ought to ever forgive. Death buries all injuries, but death itself shall not bury his. No, I'll hate him even after death and persecute him beyond the grave. Out of everything that all the men in the world have either done or attempted to do against me, nothing comes near to him who, because my Erythea proved true to her first vows, was resolved to follow her banished husband and rejected his courtships, gave her a dose of poison, and murdered her." End quote. The letters of the tyrant Phalaris, including that one, were proved in 1699 AD to be second century forgeries by one of the heroes of this telebroadcast, Richard Bentley. But just from listening to that, does anyone think that someone like a Christian apologist would easily be able to determine that it was a forgery? I mean, there's nothing improbable in there. It's just a guy talking about how he hates some guy. Looks like an ancient letter. The language checks out. It's short, concise. Hints at some historical information. His wife was murdered by this man, Python, at a time when Phalaris had been exiled, and he writes letters to his wife earlier in the collection as well, before her death. There's no obvious anachronisms. You know, he's not busting out a reference to My Neighbor Totoro, but Richard Bentley demonstrated that this letter was a forgery solely because of the so-called wise saying that the author quoted, "Since all must die, so too should their anger." And he had to develop a very lengthy and complex argument from the fact that the structure of that saying showed that it was a comedic verse. And at the time that this was supposedly written, there hadn't actually been any comedic plays yet and wouldn't be for a few generations. That's the kind of argument that's deployed when identifying a forgery, because apologists seem to have this expectation that forgery will out, so to speak. A forgery is supposed to just be wall-to-wall anachronisms and stupid tells, according to them, but that's not the case. A lot of times, inconsistencies can only be exposed at the most basic, granular level. Now, my hypothesis in this series is that the Pliny letter was forged in order to influence the Roman legal discourse on what we may call the persecution of Christians. And to that end, the forger cannot rightfully have Pliny praising Christianity. His requirement is simple. He needs a Roman official to acknowledge that the Romans are opposed to Christianity, but nonetheless prescribe leniency in some fashion. This is the exact procedure that was followed in the forging of all the various letters and rescripts and imperial edicts that we'll discuss in this series. In the best case scenario, you might actually succeed in fooling a local governor or headman outright with something written above the name of Trajan that sets clear ground rules on what not to do when persecuting Christians, maybe. But at a minimum, what you're aiming for is to have the Romans adopt more lenient measures and make it seem like it was their own idea. And another thing you're aiming for is to disseminate this among Christians so that when their number is called by the Roman state, they can bring up some of the elements of this Pliny letter, and it may help them de-escalate the persecution going on in their area. And to some, this type of thing might seem silly, but these were not the most sophisticated people on either side of the equation. They didn't have what we would call modern sensibilities. But if this scheme is what you're going to go with, to pull it off in any coherent way, you need to sound like a Roman. And to pull that off, you need to write like you hate Christians. And you know what? One of the reasons that Pliny in this letter is portrayed by the forger as not knowing anything about Christians, and he learns a little about them only by torturing a couple of slaves, is because the forger indeed probably didn't have the stomach to write up a blistering invective against Christianity and put it in the mouth of this pagan. All Pliny ends up learning about it, according to the letter, is largely positive information from the lapsed Christians, and then he says that he tortures a few lowly slaves, and from there he gets another impression, and that's when he says the nastiest thing he can muster about Christianity, which is only that it's a depraved and extravagant superstition. It's like, my God, can he say that? And the forger is obviously pulling his punches. Then, like I said earlier, he goes on to say that it's leading everyone into danger. But again, that's in the context of him also talking about how successful and popular it is. All this to say, the argument that the letter seems authentic because Pliny speaks negatively about Christians is not really a very solid one at all, and we'll continue to revisit that. For one thing, it ignores the forger's intent. And also, again, forgery is not always so obvious. If you work in an office that has about 30 people and they all try their hand at forging a document, and you know what? You might actually want to try this, especially if you work at like a financial services company or a law firm. Just have a nice forgery day, just a social experiment. You'll find that you're not going to get uniform results either in their approach, their artifice, the competence of their forgery, and the same applies to forgeries in the ancient world. And in my opinion, this Pliny letter is only a semi-competent forgery. The forger was technically sound, but he simply gave himself too much to do, and it left more loose ends than he could possibly tie up. You're listening to Born in the Second Century, and it's now July 20th, 2021. This is episode 11 of the tri-weekly teleplay on the late origins of the New Testament and the Christian religion, hosted by Chris Palmero, and the music for today's broadcast was provided by the recording group Pompey Gray. We continue our investigation of the so-called Pliny letter, that is, the letter from Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan from the year 112 AD, supposedly, asking advice on the legal procedures to be conducted against Christians in the province of Bithynia. It's part of our general custom of examining contemporary pagan and Greco-Roman sources for early Christianity and to demonstrate that they don't conflict with the hypothesis of a late origin for Christianity, a second century origin. And I'm going through this letter like I'm in the bloodstream level of the video game Bart's Nightmare, you know, inflating and popping and disposing of the various arguments for its authenticity, just like the viruses that Bart confronted in that stage with his air pump. My approach is to maintain that the Pliny letter was a forgery created at the hands of Christian clerics in the late 100s AD, most likely the 180s. It's very similar in spirit to the forged pagan writings that Tertullian mentions in his Apology from the turn of the 3rd century, and all of them featured Roman officials calling for leniency when persecuting Christians. The Roman officials in those forged documents accept in some way that Christianity is illegal, but the forgers have them issue caveats to make the persecution and prosecution of Christians a bit less chaotic. Pliny's letter is one such document among four that Tertullian cites, and the specific objectives of forging Pliny's letter were to recommend that Christians not be hunted down, particularly on the basis of tips from anonymous informants, and also to provide cover for apostates to get clear from being associated with Christianity. It gave them a parachute cord to pull, so to speak, whereby they could simply apostatize, sacrifice to the emperor, and in so doing, they would lose any stigma that had attached to them from ever having the name of Christian. And the reason the forger thought that was important was because in his mind, and not all Christians may have shared this opinion, in his mind, it was much better for the Christian church to cut its losses in the case of a weak-willed believer who was under threat of lapsing. It's far better for the church if an apostate can just deny Christ and have his name cleared and just get the hell off the books than that the stigma of being a Christian attaches to him for life and he can never clear his name. And as a result, you're now still at risk of being wrapped up in a future persecution someday because of him. The forger tries to accomplish these objectives by writing them above Trajan's name. He creates a letter from Pliny to Trajan to get him there. That shouldn't seem too far-fetched because, as we'll see throughout this series, there are well-known examples of Christians from this period doing just this very thing, forging imperial edicts and letters, where they have the emperor of the day recommending light treatment of the Christians. It isn't just the four bogus writings that Tertullian cites, there are others, and we'll cover those. If anyone thinks that it sounds kind of weird and kind of dumb that Christians of the second century thought that they could essentially forge a Roman law into being just by writing a pseudepigraphon, don't look at me. I didn't come up with that idea myself. You know, when I was in my cups or whatever, the early Christians did, and they did it at least six times that we know of. So go talk to whoever forged the letter of Hadrian to Fundanus, for example. So today we'll begin our close reading of Pliny's letter, but we'll quickly find that our main means of proving its illegitimacy will be to demonstrate that it doesn't have any valid legal background. The depiction of persecution in the letter and its legal background is based on stereotyped Christian tropes rather than actual Roman law. Pliny and Trajan assume that Christianity is illegal before they even put pen to paper. In fact, Christianity has to be illegal for the letter to work, so to speak, and Christians had to be legally persecuted before Pliny for the letter to make any sense. And we'll find that the consensus among theologians to explain this is that the Emperor Nero from the 50s and 60s AD persecuted Christians and established, if not a standing law, then at least a known custom governing the persecution of Christians. And we'll demonstrate that the entire concept of a persecution of Christians by Nero is based on myth. I spoke about the red cards last time, the arguments against the authenticity of the Pliny letter, and here we are dealing mainly with red card 2, the persecution trope. We get a stereotyped cookie-cutter view of persecution in this letter that has no legitimate legal basis that we can point to. In each episode, I ask you to keep a certain question in mind as we go through the material, and it differs in each show, but in this Pliny letter series, we want to keep the same question in mind throughout, and that is that as we continue to go over all the arguments, all the evidence that this Pliny letter might be inauthentic, we want to be asking ourselves whether it is in fact impossible to think of the Pliny letter as a forgery. And I don't mean impossible in some academic, philosophical sense, because of course, it's not impossible to simply state that something could be a forgery. What I mean by impossible is that of all the writings that we will ever talk about on this show, Pliny's letter and the response by Trajan has, I would say, the strongest consensus as to its authenticity, not just by theologians, but by mainstream historians. Even with Paul's letters, there's some weird problem that's been acknowledged by the mainstream somewhere in each one, even when the letters as a whole are considered authentic, like 2 Corinthians 6:14 through 7:1. Even fundamentalists have admitted that that passage stands out from the rest of the text, had to be added at a later time. Mainstream theologians have already been there for quite a while. And there are things like that throughout all the New Testament books. And when it comes to Josephus, for example, there's not really a consensus as to whether his statements about Christians and Jesus are genuine. There are still those who argue for the inauthenticity of the Tacitus passage about Christians, though not many, and we'll talk about that today, but this Pliny letter is commonly seen as unitary and genuine. It has a practically spotless reputation, and all we need to do, according to the theologians, is just study what's in it. The question we should always be keeping in mind is whether we have to accept that, or whether there's not in fact a reason for doubt. In fact, many reasons. Back after this. So we'll now begin our close reading of the Pliny letter, and it will unfold over multiple episodes, maybe 3 or 4 more after this, possibly 300 or 400 at this rate. As we go through it, I'll address damn near every word and bring in my arguments against authenticity, the red cards that I introduced in the last show. Today, however, I'm going to be hyper-focused on one of them, what I called Red Card 2, the persecution trope. Understanding what I call the persecution trope is fundamental to understanding this letter and why it was forged. Now, this letter is usually said to fit right in with what we quote-unquote know about persecutions going on against the Christians in that era. But what I hope to show is that what we know about persecutions going on against the Christians in that era is largely false. It's exaggerated and stereotyped from unreliable sources that are kind of stitched together by theologians to form a coherent narrative. So let's begin this historic mission, what I hope will be the most comprehensive argument for the forgery of this thing in 1,500 years. But before that, I want us to first read Trajan's response to Pliny very briefly, because this response by Trajan is what the forger is actually trying to get to. We should always keep it in mind. I'm dead sure that this response by Trajan was written first, that is, before Pliny's letter to Trajan, because this is the end product. This is the work product, if you will. This is the fake imperial rescript. This is what the forger is trying to insert into the discourse about prosecution and persecution. And here, as always, we'll go with the Wynne Williams translation. Quote, "You followed the procedure which you ought to have followed, my dear Secundus, in examining the cases of those who were being prosecuted before you as Christians. For no rule with a universal application, such as would have, as it were, a fixed form, can be laid down. They should not be sought out. If they're prosecuted and are proved to be guilty, they should be punished, provided, however, that the man who denies that he is a Christian and makes this evident by his action, that is, by offering prayers to our gods, shall obtain pardon for his repentance, however suspect he may be with regard to the past. However, pamphlets posted up without an author's name ought to have no place in any criminal charge, for they both set the worst precedent and are out of keeping with the spirit of our age." End quote. Now, if you notice, he said, we can't lay down a fixed and universal rule. And in the very next sentence, he said, if they're prosecuted and proved to be guilty, they should be punished. Well, that, sir, is what is generally called a fixed and universal rule. But this is what the forger wanted to put out into the ether. These 6 sentences, there's something profound in them, something that he thinks will be of moment in the Roman persecution of Christians. So what is it? We can almost disregard Pliny's actual letter to Trajan here. Like I said, it all led up to this response. Well, if these 6 sentences became the law of the land, or at least some kind of regional precedent that could be cited elsewhere, this is what would happen as of the very next day. Christians wouldn't be hunted down like the Nexus 6 replicants, even if there was hue and cry in the provinces among the unwashed masses who were keen to drag them to the tribunal. Anyone who accuses a Christian must present the accusation in person. The Christian will still be punished with death if he admits to being a Christian. Another way to put that is, true Christians still have the opportunity for glorious martyrdom. On the other hand, those who deny the Christian faith are given an escape route. Crucially, they are no longer considered guilty of any other crimes that the mob usually associates with Christianity. The crimes that are called, in Latin, the flagitia. In this series, I'll call them the unspeakable crimes. Infanticide, orgies, incest. In denying Christianity, these people are basically being given the Catwoman clean slate that wipes out their criminal record. Anne Hathaway. And lastly, anonymous posted accusations against the Christians will never be honored. These things taken together mean that faithful, believing Christians are no longer under the threat of being caught up in a giant dragnet or Interpol crackdown on account of rumors from the mob accusing them of the unspeakable crimes, especially when those rumors are directed against those who are no longer Christians. Make no mistake, it would have been a huge boon to the early clerics if these things were put in place. Now, imagine that we are living in Anatolia in 160 AD. There's a Christian in our village who has left the faith. Call him Publius. Yet, he's a real jerk. So he gets maliciously ratted out by the pagans of the town, but because he's such a bad guy, he points the finger at all of us other Christians and wants to take us all down with him. Classic Publius, am I right? Now, the best case scenario for the church there would be for this Schmendrick to be allowed to recant his faith and move on, with the state forgetting that he'd ever even been a Christian, and without any of the stigma of his accusation spreading to us. Don't let this imbecile's legal predicament ensnare other Christians. This Trajan rescript is a way for the church to limit exposure, and limiting exposure is the goal, as opposed to just forging a letter from Trajan that says, don't persecute the Christians at all. Because the everyday Christians, especially the less sophisticated ones, do not want to perceive that the road to suffering and martyrdom, imitating the deity, imitating Jesus, imitating the legendary apostles, is closed off to them personally. So what we get instead is this highly legalizing text that limits the persecution of Christians and makes it less indiscriminate, less volatile, and cuts the church loose from any liability that may arise from a false Christian or lapsed Christian implicating them in his own legal troubles. You know, if we want to get killed by the Roman state and die for the name of Jesus, don't call us, we'll call you. That's the scenario this Pliny letter is meant to establish. And the goal here is to just push this out into the world and see whether it helps. Maybe a cleric somewhere can use this to some effect when dealing with Roman magistrates that are threatening his church. Maybe a Roman legal expert might read this, or a Roman official, and it might give them pause, might influence their thinking, their procedures. Now, there's a good faith argument that can be made against me here. Someone might say, you're arguing that the Christians are trying to steer the Romans to a more enlightened, less indiscriminate policy. But couldn't this letter of Trajan simply be an instance of the Romans themselves arriving at a more enlightened policy all on their own? And therefore, it might be a genuine letter in that respect? I mean, certainly the Romans, at least on paper, hated legal abuses just as much as anyone else. And this could be an example of them unilaterally setting ground rules to limit unfair treatment or zealous prosecution. And I would be inclined to accept that argument were it not for one key thing. This letter of Trajan, to say nothing of the letter of Pliny that prompts it, presupposes that Christianity is already a crime. That is the theme of Trajan's response. Notice that he says, if they're prosecuted and found guilty, they should be punished. Guilty of what? Guilty of being a Christian, as he says in the first sentence. For this enlightened, just letter to be genuine, it presupposes a world in which all the parties to the letter have some understanding that Christianity itself is illegal on its face, and not only that, but that there are clear, unambiguous precedents and even laws to that effect. What this episode will demonstrate is that that was not even close to being the case, and it's highly questionable that the Roman state was even aware of Christianity until after the 130s AD. Neither Pliny nor Trajan cite any pre-existing laws. They're not representing themselves making a change to any existing laws. The reader is supposed to accept that Christianity is already illegal, and that is not even in question, even here. Where Trajan himself has ultimate power to create and modify laws, even here in the precedent-crazed Roman legal world of the second century, the time period in which the jurist Ulpian would publish 50 entire books of nothing but precedents. So you see, when we pull that foundation out from under the letter, we have to default to the idea that it was a Christian forgery, and it was rather the Christians who were calling for that ideal, enlightened, just situation that was established by Trajan in their letter. Because if there were, in fact, no clear precedents that Christianity was already illegal, then the Pliny letter makes absolutely no sense. I cannot emphasize that enough. So let's get to it. Letters 1096 and 1097 of Pliny's Epistulae. We begin with the first line. Pliny writing to Trajan, quote, "Solemne est mi, Domine, omnia de quibus dubito ad te refere." No, just kidding. No. "This is it, old boy, we're going to go out speaking the kings." But that is the first line in Latin, and I read it because you get the sense when you hear that language read the way it should be, you do get the sense of how it is that the Romans could get away with declaring themselves the rightful administrators of the entire world, because if someone starts talking like that to you, even if you're a lowly Illyrian poopsmith who doesn't even understand a word of it, you're going to at least get the sense that you better start shaping up. I mean, whatever he's telling you to do, it's probably some seriously important shit. You know, as a kid, I never understood why Gandalf was so adamant about how no one should ever speak the black speech of Mordor. Like, every time someone does, he says, like, "That tongue has not been heard here for many an age." But I guess this gives us some hint as to why. Now, on the subject of languages, Bart Ehrman had a funny anecdote in one of his books. I guess in biblical studies, you have to learn German and French because they're some of the languages of scholarship, and there are a lot of big journal articles written in those languages. And he said that his professor of German would speak only in German, and he would tell jokes, and the students like Bart Ehrman and others would just kind of laugh when it sounded like he got to a punchline because, you know, they didn't understand what all he was saying. I mean, it's funny, but I don't know. I may be showing my Asha here, but I don't believe that a lot of these American theologians can read German or French on that academic level. I mean, come on. But let's begin the letter for real this time. First line. "It's my custom, my lord, to bring before you everything about which I'm in doubt. For who can better guide my uncertainty or better inform my ignorance? I've never been present at trials of Christians. I therefore don't know what the charge usually is and to what extent it's punished." End quote. There are at least four red cards that I would like to hold up right now based on this sentence alone, but as it turns out, Pliny used the phrase of the day, trials of Christians. So we will end up focusing today on the biggest and most glaring of the red cards, number two, the persecution trope. The late second century Christians tell us how they're treated by the Roman state. They're unjustly hated. They're subject to rumors. They're universally mocked, laughed at for proclaiming that God will one day judge the world, ridiculed for their fables. They're the lowest dregs, the unskilled, skulking and shunning the light, but garrulous in corners. Credulous and yielding women are prominent in their ranks. They worship the head of a donkey. They worship the sun. They worship the genitals of their priests. A profane conspiracy, leagued together by nightly meetings and solemn fasts. Triflers and babblers, the vilest of mankind, talking nonsense among women and boys, among maidens and the elderly. They're a third race of men that doesn't fit in anywhere. Men and women of all ages and ranks are passing over to them, enemies of the state, enemies of the human race. The late second century Christians tell us what crimes they're accused of by rumors instigated by demons. They're accused of being atheists. They're accused of wanting to set up a new kingdom, accused of not reverencing the gods of the cities, accused of eating human flesh, that of an infant, in an initiation rite in which they're pledged together by the sacrifice of the innocent victim, accused of incestuous banquets in which a dog is incited to overturn a lamp, creating a shameless darkness for incestuous liaisons, loaves steeped in blood, dissolute marriages, impious lust, treason, abominations, horrid and monstrous crimes. That is quite the rap sheet, Prison Mike. Technically, in the Roman Empire, you could be executed for bribery, so I can only imagine what the penalty for all these violations would be. Probably death, I'd imagine. Maybe the late second century Christians will also tell us about how these charges played in court. Let's see. They say, "You punish us without judgment and don't inquire into our deeds. You receive the name as proof against us. If the accused denies the name, you acquit him as having no evidence against him as a wrongdoer." Wait, what? They say, "You torture us to confess so that we might deny. If anyone denies that he's a Christian, you show favor to him as if by forswearing that name, he atoned for all his deeds at once by that simple denial. You punish us without consideration or judgment. You don't inquire into our deeds." Huh? You don't investigate our charges. Your judges, instead of inquiring whether we've committed any crime, vent their insults on the name, as if that itself were a crime, assailed with abuse on a judgment formed without examination. The accusation relates merely to our name. The name has more force than the evidence adduced on the trial. You persecute us by imagining that in the very fact of our being Christians, we sin against life. No crime stands against us but the crime of a name. When we deny under torture, you believe at once. In everything, you deal differently with us than with other criminals. I feel like we missed something here because these were quotes from 15 different Christian books from between the years 150 AD and 215 AD. And in all of them, we started out with, "The Romans hate everything about us. We're accused of these abominable, hyper-specific, and detailed crimes. But when we're actually put on trial, it turns out that we are really being tried for something called the name." And in fact, all we have to do is just say that we are not Christians. And it's like, don't worry about eating that infant, because you said the magic word no, so you're free to go. And in fact, you also get a clean slate, like the one that Catwoman was trying to get. It's clear that in the minds of these Christians of the time, the real reason they're being put on trial is simply because they are Christians. And it's something that makes sense to them and for the tiny audience of weirdos that they're writing to. The problem is that because of 1900 years of bad habit, it also makes sense to us. It is a fundamental element of the Christian worldview that living as a Christian in the visible world is offensive to non-Christians in some way. That's what this ancient Christian narrative reflects. There's a strange disconnect that we're seeing here in which the Christians never say that they're being tried for a specific crime. They're accused of what are actually quite monstrous crimes, but when they're hauled before the tribunal, these crimes are apparently of no import because now all the authorities seem to care about is whether or not the accused is a Christian. And as I explained last time, theologians have valiantly stepped into the breach here and said, well, the Romans are really accusing them of being an illegal club or illicit religion, or accusing them of sacrilege because in the empire, civic society and religion were intermingled. So if you didn't participate in the state cult, then you were ipso facto a public enemy. When you say things like that, you're just putting your hand on the ancient Christian's bike seat to steady the bike. You're helping them get to a point that you want them to get to so that these whack-ass persecution stories make sense. Because they are not actually saying that they're being tried for the crimes that the theologians are attributing to them. Like, that illegal club thing, for example, is mentioned twice in like 250,000 words of these books. And it's not even clear that they were actually trying to say that they were even being accused of it, let alone tried for it. Added to which, when it comes to crimes like sacrilege or treason, either you committed treason or you didn't. There is a trial procedure in place for that. Even if you want to claim that, well, by getting someone to admit that they're not a Christian, that's effectively the same thing to the Romans as them saying that they didn't commit treason. Well, if that were the case, then all of the narratives in these Christian writings would look strikingly different. For one thing, they wouldn't complain that they're being hailed before the court on no specific charge, as every single one of them does. The Christian's own narrative about persecution in and of itself is confusing, to say the least. Now, it's clear that something was going on, but it's impossible to separate fiction from fact, because this depiction of their own circumstances sounds almost like a conspiracy theory. And there's no corroboration from Roman sources that we can point to substantiate it, and more importantly, no Roman law that could even justify these narratives and help us make sense of them. But in summary, the Christians are saying that the mob accuses them of crimes. They're brought before a judge. They have to confess whether or not they're a Christian. If they do, they're executed. If they don't, they'll go free. So before we start investigating whether there was an actual law in place against Christians, let's try to make sense of what they might be talking about by way of a helpful analogy. Now, I want to say that doing what is already a controversial show, bringing up and talking about Judaism so much is kind of a touchy proposition. Every time I do it, it feels like when they were trying to move the dynamite that was in those crates in Lost. Because even if, like me, you don't actually have any cancel-worthy opinions, you learn pretty quickly when you're dealing with apologists that they're always ready on a hair trigger to accuse you of any monstrosity, including things you did not actually say. Kind of like how the ancient Christians were accused of crimes they didn't commit, am I right? So while the ancient persecution of Jews in the 1st century BC and 1st and 2nd centuries AD is probably our best possible analogy here, and as such, we'll talk about it much more next time, we'll take a break from that controversial topic for now and focus on something else for the specific analogy that I want to use here, which is slavery in the American South before the Civil War. One of the most striking observations that was made about the black slaves in the southern United States was that although they were restricted from information about the outside world by the slave owners to the extent possible, news and reports seemed to circulate very rapidly among them nonetheless, especially when that news had to do with slavery as such, be it an escape or a rebellion. It was said that someone could depart from Virginia on the day that a slave revolt happened there and travel to Mississippi, and when they landed in Mississippi, they would find that the local slaves would somehow know about the revolt in Virginia even before the local white population did. And this, like I said, despite the fact that they were deliberately kept out of the loop, and the travel and communications technology in the antebellum South, while not exactly equivalent, was not too far advanced beyond that of the Roman Empire. To travel 800 miles in the United States in the early 1800s could take 6 weeks. To travel 800 miles in the ancient Roman Empire took 6.4 weeks if you were going by land. Plus, the empire was centered on the Mediterranean. Traveling between those port cities was just as easy as taking a connecting flight. Getting from Rome to Corinth took just over a week, and half of that time consisted of schlepping your ass down to Messana. If you were sailing to Corinth from the East Coast, it took only 5 days. The point is, just as it did among an oppressed population in the pre-war South, news and rumor traveled very quickly among a marginalized population in the empire, especially when that news had to do with them. All this to say, if it happened that someone, somewhere, some lowly Roman official or some belligerent head of a town or village somewhere, acting completely independently, attacked Christians in the manner that they're freaking out about in their books, that is, accusing them of the unspeakable crimes, hauling them before the court, torturing them and compelling them to confess to Christianity, letting them go free if they did confess, if this happened even once or twice in the second century, it could have circulated around the Christian communities of the Mediterranean very quickly. And it would have had a big impact on them. It's news they can use because it happens to fit their narrative, a sectarian narrative, inherited from Judaism, especially the apocalyptic cults within Judaism, as we'll get into next time, that they are hated by the world merely for the name. That is the name of God, or the name of Christ in this case. It would be an irresistible subject and trope for an author like Justin to write about. And by the way, what's not often mentioned, all the Christian writers of this period who repeat this persecution narrative are following Justin in some way, whether copying him directly or copying someone who copied him. And as I just said, the report that they're giving us in their books is a mere narrative. Never forget that in the background of all this is an issue of law. This is the Roman Empire and the legal norms, traditions, and public laws thereof. This isn't just the panopticon fever dream of some obscure church father writing to an audience of about a dozen like-minded clerics. If the early Christians are in some way misled, if they were really being punished for sacrilege, then what they say about their mode of conviction and punishment would better reflect that, and it doesn't. Now, it is true that local administrators had a sort of general authority to maintain order, called coercitio, And as I said, it could be that in one or maybe even a tiny handful of cases in the mid-second century, a particularly zealous administrator responding to the fury and accusations of a mob dragged some Christians into the docket and imposed upon them this Kafkaesque trial, conviction, and punishment procedure. And the news and the report of this event reached the writing desk of Justin Martyr, who saw how this narrative could actually serve the needs of the nascent Christian clergy, and he inflated it for apologetic reasons. These horror stories, embellished and misrepresented by the likes of Justin and Tertullian and others, they could have been one-off freak occurrences, not necessarily even involving the highest councils of or the Roman state. In fact, a Roman consul might have been apoplectic to learn that this was how justice was being handled in the provinces. So a possible explanation is that a rare anomalous occurrence or series of occurrences took on a life of its own in the early church, and once that ball started rolling, it created an avalanche of embellished, fanciful accounts that culminated in what I'm calling the persecution trope. And I want to let you in on a quote in support of this. It's actually one of the most fundamental texts of Born in the Second Century, its origin, writing in the middle of the 200s AD against Celsus, insisting that there had only ever been a few martyrs to the Christian religion. Quote, "In order to remind others that by seeing a few engaged in a struggle for their religion, they also might be better fitted to despise death, some on special occasions, and these individuals can be easily numbered. Some have endured death for the sake of Christianity." End quote. Only some martyrs. Only on special occasions. And they can be easily numbered. And Origen, not to say that he's 100% reliable, but out of all the Christian writers that we cover on this show, he is the most circumspect that we could possibly hope to get. So we see that there are some questions here in these Christian tales about their own persecution, and we can't accept their stories at face value. And now we insert the Pliny letter into all this. A big part of the question as to whether the Pliny letter is genuine or forged is to what extent it actually reflects Roman legal practice against the Christians of the period. Because if it turns out that these reports by the Christians are mostly mythical, I say mostly, then it's clear what implications that has for the Pliny letter. Pliny writing to Trajan in this set of letters assumes a law against the Christians. In fact, it is the fundamental presupposition of the text, because both of them understand, without having to say it, that Christianity is in some way illegal. We've already consulted the Christian sources and determined that they're of no help in clarifying this matter. And theologians recognize this. This question of Pliny's legal precedence is the frame that supports the whole superstructure of the letter. And ironically, you know, forget now about Pliny not knowing about Christians, forget about his dumbass statement that they're bankrupting the temples. This same question about what is the legal precedent here is also, paradoxically, the weak link in the chain when it comes to the authenticity of this thing. Theologians have brainstormed several possible scenarios as to how it is that Pliny and Trajan can know that Christianity is illegal. And this summary comes from the theologian Paul Koreshtes, who's an expert on this persecution topic. And he says that there are three possibilities for how the Christians were being tried during Pliny's time and before his time. One possibility is that Christians were punished under what's called coercitio, that is, as I said earlier, a general, broad mandate police action intended to maintain order. Another is that they're being punished for regular violations of the law. And the third is that they're being punished under a special, specific law. And for various reasons, and I totally agree with them, theologians have not found enough compelling evidence for the first two possibilities. Only the third makes sense, the special law. A law had to have been passed against Christians in the first century for this Pliny letter to make sense. And the theologians were kind of forced to this consensus. As we see, there are only three possibilities here, and all three of them, frankly, suck. And if Christians were being punished under a special law, we're at a disadvantage because we don't know about any such laws like this from the time. And that's not to say that there weren't any, but since we don't have that direct evidence, theologians have to guess as to when this special law was passed and what they've settled on, the consensus. Is that in Pliny's world, in Trajan's world, the laws against Christians that they're obliquely referring to, whose existence they're assuming, come from a measure that was passed against Christians in the time of Nero, during a persecution by him. And so what we seek to prove in the remainder of this episode is that the supposed persecution of Christians under Nero and any supposed legal action against them by Nero never actually happened. In fact, as I believe, Nero and the Romans of his time were not even aware of such a thing as Christians. To the extent that Christians existed during the reign of Nero, which was 54 AD to 68 AD, they existed as Jewish Gnostic proto-Christian sects, barely distinguishable from the Jews and the Judaism of the time, at least to an external observer. Back after this. A reading from Tertullian's Apology from the turn of the 3rd century. Consult your histories. There you'll find that Nero was the first who assailed the Christian sect with the imperial sword, and he made progress especially at Rome. But we glory in having our condemnation hallowed by the hostility of such a wretch, because anyone who knows him understands that nothing brought on Nero's condemnation unless it was singularly excellent. Domitian, too, a man of Nero's type in cruelty, tried his hand at persecution, but because he had something of the human in him, he soon put an end to what he'd begun. He even restored those whom he'd banished. Such as these have always been our persecutors, unjust men, impious, base, of whom even you yourselves have no good to say, the sufferers under whose sentences you've been wont to restore. But among so many princes from that time to the present day, with anything of divine and human wisdom in them, point out a single persecutor of the Christian name. That was a reading from Tertullian, and a reading now from an alleged book of Melito of Sardis, allegedly from the 170s AD, allegedly written to the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. The greatest proof that our belief was for the good at the time the empire began is this. Since the reign of Augustus, no disaster has overtaken the empire, but rather everything splendid and glorious, the answer to every prayer. Of all the emperors, the only ones ever persuaded by evil advisors to slander our teaching were Nero and Domitian. And from them stemmed the unreasonable practice of falsely accusing the Christians. But their ignorance was corrected by your pious fathers, who regularly reprimanded in writing all who dared to take new measures against us. That was a supposed quote from Melito. Melito of Sardis was a mysterious Christian writer from about the 170s. We're told that he was a bishop in Asia Minor. We have hardly any of his writings today, but we can say with some confidence that he existed. Clement more or less quotes him right away. Irenaeus appears to borrow from his writings, and Tertullian will later leave the Catholic Church in a huff to go become a heretic, and he'll decide that he now hates Melito, and he'll famously call him the prophet of the psychics. And psychics was a name that heretics of the time called regular Christians. But that last reading, the one from Melito, only shows up in the writings of the historian Eusebius from the 300s AD. As I said in episode 1, Eusebius preserves a lot of these one-off passages that we find nowhere else but in his books. Some of them come from known Christians of the early centuries, but some, like in the fragment of Quadratus that I covered in the first episode, come from Christians that we don't otherwise know about except through Eusebius. Now, this fragment of Melito that he gives us here is one of about 10 total fragments in the books of Eusebius that I unequivocally maintain is a forgery by Eusebius, because Because remember, he's writing the history of the earliest church. The problem is that he has very few sources with which to populate those early decades of church history, the first and second centuries. And he has a tendency, when he feels that the history for a particular time period is a bit light, to mysteriously double up on his info. He'll often give two quotes from sources that are essentially saying the exact same thing. And that's the case here. He quotes both of these passages, the one from Tertullian and the one from Melito. Now, you have to understand that Eusebius in his history book is basically doing born in the first century. One of his primary goals is to prove the antiquity of Christianity and that it goes back to the reign of Tiberius in the early first century. And you have to wonder why he would feel the need to do that if the early history of the church was supposedly so well attested. But exactly like modern theologians, once he gets done covering the New Testament, he finds that there's a giant frickin' gap for about 150 years, for which he can only find a handful of legitimate sources, and those start to come in only toward the end of that 150-year period. So where he's missing sources for a time period or only has one source for a time period, he just makes them up. And this supposed quote of Melito that he gives us, which, by the way, sounds like no other writing that we possess from Melito, if you notice, it simply restated what was already in the Tertullian passage. It says that nothing bad happened to the Christians until Nero persecuted them. Hardly any information is given about what Nero did. Then it says that Domitian persecuted the Christians. No further info given. Then it says that they were the only two enemies that the church ever had. Then it says that since then, no emperor has repeated those crimes against the Christians. Exact same thing in both passages. Now, Melito here says that the second century emperors, far from persecuting Christians, actually rebuked anyone who tried to do so in writing. In a part that I didn't read, he will then give examples of those letters that the later emperors wrote. And suspiciously, the examples that he gives are the exact same ones that Eusebius also told us about in an earlier chapter, the ones that he found in the writings of Justin. So we find ourselves trapped once again in the Eusebius-Bermuda Triangle, where it turns out that three sources are giving us identical information about a particular time period, and then you remember that in the ancient world, a multiplicity of sources, no matter how fanciful, was considered resounding proof that an event in history was true, and all the more so for people coming out of Judaism and Christianity, where it says in Deuteronomy and 2 Corinthians that a matter is established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. So three carbon copy testimonies to them would have been unanswerable. To us in the modern world, however, or at least to those of us in the modern world who aren't also theologians, it's a tad suspicious. It's a bit too nice and neat that we are getting clean facsimiles of the same information when we're dealing with such complicated issues. Now, just as an aside, Eusebius is doing born in the first century. Like I said, I'm doing born in the second century. And in episode 9, I explained about the mountain man theory. He's doing born in the fourth century. So what we still need is someone to do born in the third century so that we can be able to summon Planetina. Now, to explain why Tertullian and Melito are saying the exact same thing here, theologians claim that Tertullian was aware of Melito's writings and was using them. But in that case, we would have to strike his testimony as superfluous if he was just copying some other guy. But having really looked at Tertullian in depth, I don't actually believe that this moron was just slavishly copying someone else, because he's clearly building out his own rhetorical argument. The Apology book by Tertullian is an updated version of an earlier book that he wrote, and the passage about Nero that's in it that we just read is based on a passage that was also in that earlier book, and there, all that Tertullian had said was that Nero passed a law against the Christians, and for some reason, that's the only law of his that's still around to this day. Well, in his second version of this argument from his apology, as we can see, he dropped that idea entirely. Now, Nero is just vaguely said to be a persecutor. There's no mention of any law. Now he just says, consult your histories, and you can learn that Nero harmed the Christians. So whatever the hell Tertullian thinks he's doing, he's not following Melito. He's doing his own thing, as usual. Tertullian is like that kind of jerk type A person of whom we see so many today who claim that My Way by Frank Sinatra is their favorite song, like because they think it was written especially about them. Now, apologists say that when he says consult your histories, he's talking about the books of Tacitus that we'll mention in a minute. But I regret to inform you that he will go on later to state that Tacitus is a liar and can never be trusted. And it's extremely clear that Tertullian had read the books of Tacitus, and in them, he didn't see anything in his time about Nero persecuting Christians after the great fire of Rome. Now think about that. Tertullian is a Latin speaker, lives in the West, knows his Tacitus fairly well, could have taken full advantage of the fact that in the Tacitus passage about the great fire that we find in our modern copies, the Christians are represented as innocent of the very charge of arson that they were punished for. But not only does he not reference anything like that at all, on the contrary, he in so many words calls Tacitus a schlemiel. But at any rate, what happened here basically was that Tertullian wrote his first book, and sometime after that, he got his hands on that compilation of forged Christian documents that I mentioned in the last two episodes, and he used that to flesh out his second book, and he used examples from it, like what we see here about Nero being the first to assail Christians with the sword. As we see, he doesn't give us any specific information on what Nero did, how he persecuted the Christians, what laws were passed, if any. Now, if there was no actual law passed by Nero against Christians, then what is the ultimate source of Tertullian's information to the effect that Nero was a persecutor? Well, one likely source is the Acts of Paul, the late second century writing that he trashes elsewhere, which nonetheless contains a story about Paul being beheaded by Nero. Of course, the Acts of Paul is about as historical as Denver the Last Dinosaur. Also, there was a contemporary legend that Peter had been executed by Nero, and that shows up in the Christian sections of the Ascension of Isaiah. But the main source of Tertullian's information about Nero being a persecutor, and we'll see this again too in the next episode when it comes to the Emperor Domitian, his main source was the Book of Revelation. The Book of Revelation is going to get its own series on this show. Suffice it to say for now that it was originally a Jewish text. In its lifespan as a Jewish text, it was written in two stages. Some of the material comes from the reign of Nero, and it was added to and completed in the reign of Domitian in the 90s. The early version of Revelation was very much akin to other apocalyptic Jewish sectarian writings of the period, like 4th Ezra, and one of the themes of Revelation, the original Jewish version of Revelation, is a bitter invective against the arch persecutors of Jews, the primary of whom was Nero. Among other things, he started the war against them that leveled the temple. Revelation, in fact, portrays Nero as the last of the enemies that will make war against the saints, and they're referring to the legend of the reincarnated Nero that would return someday. That was a popular legend in the early 100s AD, especially among Jews, and the mark of the beast, 666 or 616, is a fairly straightforward reference to Nero, and in fact, in the very midst of this section, which is crammed with all these Nero tropes, the author of Revelation says, apropos of nothing, that if anyone is destined for captivity, he'll go into captivity. If anyone kills with the sword, he will be killed with the sword. And that's been taken by many to be a reference to Nero's fate, that is Nero 1.0, the actual Nero from history. Now recall Tertullian's wording about how Nero persecuted the church. He assailed it with the imperial sword. Taken by itself, it's strange language, is it not? But this passage from Revelation puts it in a bit better perspective. Tertullian, or his source, appears to have extrapolated Nero's career as a persecutor from contemporary legends and an exegesis of the Book of Revelation, one that was actually standard for the time. He knows nothing of any Roman law instituted by Nero that he can cite, nothing from any Roman source, except he does issue us the Mark Summers double dare physical challenge by telling us to go read a bunch of Roman history to learn about how Nero was a persecutor. Here he's most likely referring to some Christian forgery from his ridiculous compilation book that we no longer have. Most importantly, he never mentions the very thing, close to the only thing, that theologians of today give as the proof of persecution under Nero, which is the execution of Christians after the great fire in Rome in 64 AD. No, Tertullian just knows that Nero was a persecutor. Tertullian also knows jack shit about the circumstances of that persecution. and a crucial tell is when he says that, well, if you notice, only the bad emperors persecuted Christianity, emperors that even the Romans would agree were bad. Nero, Domitian, I mean, this is apologetics. And what on earth did we even expect? We're reading this in a book called Apology. So bottom line, the writings of Melito that deal with Nero as persecutor are forged by Eusebius. Strike them from the record. And the writings of Tertullian do not support any persecution of Christians by Nero or any substantive law or legal action taken against them. So we can strike them from the record. And in so doing, we remove one more Jenga piece that was supporting the tower of Pliny's letter. And this is where I also need to point out that according to many, including the theologian L.H. Canfield, who wrote extensively about the history of persecution, Tertullian is our best and most complete source when it comes to these things. Damn. Incidentally, we can also strike the Book of Revelation as evidence for a persecution by Nero. The Book of Revelation, as I said, was a Jewish text of the 90s AD. It included some earlier sources. At its core, it's a complex rewrite of biblical texts like Ezekiel and Exodus and many others, and we'll cover that in the Revelation series. But what happened was, sometime around the 130s, Christians got a hold of it and repurposed it into a Christian text. Kind of like how Michael Scott refashioned his pants into a tent in Survivor Man. And they added those letters to the beginning, they added those ending chapters, and they added a few key interpolations in the text, some of which are glaringly obvious, to the extent that if we were dealing with pagan writers here, pretty much everyone on earth would recognize that the text has been messed with extensively. Now, before we get to our pagan sources, let's check out the only other place where we can look to in any early Christian literature for a persecution by Nero, the document called First Clement. First Clement is a brick that everyone thinks was written in the 90s AD. It's a Jewish sermon about humility that some Christian hack has repurposed, kind of similar to Revelation, and you know, no fair use caveats or anything. I mean, if you edited and republished someone else's book like this Christian did with First Clement, you'd basically be in court for the rest of your life. It's about humility. It kind of reminds me of the Wondershowzen episode about patience, where they just repeat the word patience 50 million times. It's highly repetitive. By the way, if you're a Christian, you are required to believe that the phoenix is real because the author of First Clement cites the phoenix as proof of the general resurrection, but he also tells us that Peter and Paul were executed. He does not say that it was done by Nero. In fact, he says that the cause of their execution was jealousy and quarreling. Was Nero jealous of Peter? Like, was Nero jealous of the deal that Peter got in the Hellenistic Witness Protection Program, where we end up having absolutely no reliable historical information about Peter? I can see where Nero would be jealous of that, because he probably realized that he himself would not be fondly remembered in history, so he just waxed Peter out of jealousy. Well, it would have been nice if, when telling us about these executions, First Clement had said anything about their circumstances, but of course he doesn't, so bottom line, First Clement does not support the persecution of Christians by Nero or any substantive law or legal action taken against them, so please strike it from the record. The reason that this passage of First Clement is held up as evidence of persecution by Nero is solely because of its inappropriately early dating, and this is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. This is where unreasonably early dating gets us into trouble. Theologians put this letter in the 90s AD for no reason. I mean, check it out now if you have 18 hours to kill. It's undateable, basically. My own theory, which incidentally also explains the Peter and Paul thing, is that the letter actually comes from the 160s, and the author is dealing with an early version of the Peter and Paul martyrdom myth. And as you know, I always say that Paul's religion and mainstream Christianity, as symbolized by Peter, were separate, feuding religions. Well, the author here is writing after those two religions have been merged, and he's citing a legend that seems to reflect that both Peter and Paul were killed by the adherents of the rival sects, and he's looking back on that in shame. And if you remember episode 7, The Lost Acts of Paul, the Pauline church most certainly had a legend that Paul was killed by the early mainstream Christians. Back after this. Independent religion. Now we reach what is commonly cited as the best evidence for the persecution of Christians by Nero, the Roman historian Tacitus, in his Annals, written around 120 AD, describes the Great Fire in Rome on July 18th of the year 64. He says that of the 14 districts of the city of Rome, all but three were mostly leveled by the fire. And he begins to discuss Nero's actions in the aftermath of the fire. Now, we'll talk somewhat now about the authenticity of this passage, but of course, Tacitus here is, along with Pliny, one of the two pillars of the Argonath, as I said last time, one of the two supposedly unimpeachable sources of evidence for earliest Christianity, and as such, this passage of Tacitus, Annals 1544, necessarily deserves its own series. But we'll address it briefly here, only insofar as its value, or lack of value, as evidence for the persecution of Christians by Nero, and we'll have a bit of help from Richard Carrier, his journal article called The Prospect of a Christian Interpolation in Tacitus. Now, Tacitus says that in the aftermath of the Great Fire, Nero built an ostentatious palace. He rebuilt most of the actual city, this time with architectural precautions against future fires. He then tells us that Nero initiated public prayers, propitiation of the gods. And then Tacitus suddenly says out of nowhere, I guess this is the point where his vivance kicked in, that despite all this, Nero couldn't shake the belief of the Roman public that he himself had actually instigated the fire. And so, to get out from under suspicion, he attached the blame on a class of men loathed for their vices, whom the crowd called Christians. He punished them with the utmost cruelty. Christ, the founder of their name, had received the death penalty in the reign of Tiberius by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilatus. This checked the pernicious superstition for the moment, but in time it broke out once more, not only in Judea, but also in Rome. The confessed members of the sect were arrested. Vast numbers were convicted, not even so much for starting the fire as for hatred of the human race. They were covered with the skins of wild beasts, torn to death by dogs, hung up on crosses, and set on fire to illuminate the night. Set on fire, remember that. And then, in a sentence that would have made perfect sense if it had come right after the sentence that immediately preceded this whole urban legend about burning Christians, Tacitus then segues to talking about how much money Nero's rebuilding programs were costing and what kind of problems that was causing. Now, this story that Tacitus has shared with us about the arrest, conviction, torture, and burning of Christians in Rome in the 60s AD is unknown to Christian sources for 300 years after him. As we've seen, Christians in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries quote-unquote know about persecution by Nero, but they know nothing about it being connected to the fire. And while that summary of Tacitus is fresh in your mind, I want to share something else from the Christian writer Lactantius of the late 300s. At his time of writing, no Christian has yet ever spoken of a persecution during Nero's Great Fire. Lactantius tells us a story about something that happened in the reign of the emperor Diocletian in the early 4th century. Quote, "Men were employed to set the palace of Nicomedia on fire, and when some of it was burned, the blame was laid on the Christians as public enemies, and the very name of Christian grew odious because of that fire. It was said that the Christians had plotted to destroy the emperors, and that both of the emperors had nearly been burned alive in their own palace. Diocletian, inflamed with anger, immediately commanded that all his slaves should be tortured to force a confession of the plot. He sat on his tribunal and saw innocent men tormented by fire to make discovery. All the magistrates obtained special commissions to administer the torture, and they competed over who would be the first to bring the conspiracy to light. Presbyters and other church officers were seized with no evidence by witnesses or confession, condemned, and together with their families, led to execution. In burning alive, there was no distinction of sex or age, and because of their great numbers, they weren't burned one after the other, but a whole herd of them were encircled with the same fire. Servants, having millstones tied about their necks, were cast into the sea. Tortures hitherto unheard of were invented. End quote. We immediately see the similarities to the Tacitus passage, which, if you recall, the author here, Lactantius, has never heard of. We see Christians being blamed for starting a fire. We see an emperor ordering mass arrests, great numbers executed at once, strange new tortures, and of course, a mass burning of the Christians, just as in the Tacitus passage. This all happened under the emperor Diocletian in the year 303. But of course, in the Tacitus passage, we saw that Nero was responsible for similar measures against the Christians in the first century. But Lactantius here writes about this kind of thing as if it had never happened before. It's almost as if in his time, the Tacitus passage about the death of Christians after the Great Fire didn't exist. It exists in our time, so it had to have come into being sometime after Lactantius, but before the 1500s when Tacitus was first set to print. Now, might there have been a source floating around somewhere in the distant past that eventually gave someone the idea to connect the Emperor Nero with the punishment of Christians via setting them on fire? Well, I quote from the extant Acts of Paul. Paul's trial before the Emperor Nero from the late 2nd century. Nero says to Paul, "You who are my prisoner, how did you think to come by stealth into the government of the Romans and levy soldiers out of my province?" But Paul, filled with the Holy Spirit, said, "Caesar, we don't only levy soldiers out of your province, but out of the whole world. This is what's been ordained to us, that no man who wants to serve my king should ever be refused. And if you'd also like to serve him, it isn't the wealth or the splendor of this life that will save you, but submission. Because one day, he will fight against this world with fire." And when Caesar heard that, he commanded all the prisoners to be burned with fire, but Paul to be beheaded, according to the law of the Romans. We saw earlier that to the extent that the first Christians knew of a persecution under Nero, they knew of it from sources that touched on the martyrdom of Peter and Paul. Legends, in a word. And this passage of the Acts of Paul, which describes Paul's martyrdom under Nero, also has, as we see, a curious little mention of Nero punishing a large group of Christians by burning them. So the concept of the Tacitus passage already exists in embryo, and the very first Christian to ever associate Nero with a persecution of Christians in the aftermath of the Great Fire in Rome is Sulpicius Severus, all the way in the 5th century. He gives us the same details in almost the same words as we see in the Tacitus passage. We've already seen how none of the prior Christians know about this persecution after the fire. This writer of the 5th century is essentially the first, technically the second if you want to include the imbecile who forged the letters of Paul and Seneca a little bit before him. But we've seen elements of this legend slowly growing as the decades pass. What finally happened was that a Christian writer, likely in the late 300s, combined the narrative of Lactantius with the one that we saw in the Acts of Paul. The end result is the full-blown legend that we see in the sacred history, the Chronicle, of Sulpicius Severus in the beginning of the 5th century. And this account, in the writings of Severus, provided a template which could then be introduced into the manuscripts of Tacitus. And remember, our proof for this passage of Tacitus on the Neronian persecution rests essentially on a single manuscript. The passage where it sits in the text of Tacitus, out of context, interrupting the flow of the narrative, could have been made at any time in late antiquity, all the way into the medieval period. It's often said that this passage is most definitely not a forgery because it closely follows the usual style of Tacitus, but I'm here to tell you, if you're a medieval monk sitting in a cloister 18 hours a day doing nothing but copying a single book, and especially knowing that some asshole is going to correct your manuscript, like copying a book, especially back then, was not a mindless task in most cases. You really needed to stay on top of what you were writing. In that environment, you're going to be able to absorb an author's style real quick, especially when your society has no screens to distract you. You can't date women being a monk. There's no alternative source of entertainment. Your whole life is basically eat, pray, copy. Of course, you're going to be able to mimic someone's style, added to which, whoever added this passage to Tacitus already had the model of Sulpicius Severus to work off of. Also, for all that, it doesn't exactly match the style of Tacitus 100%, as we will investigate in the upcoming full series about the passage. Check local listings for that. Now, Richard Carrier's own thesis is not that the whole passage of Tacitus has been forged. It's only that, as he says, the single sentence, the one referring to Christ and his death at the hands of Pilate, has been added by a Christian. But he believes that the passage originally referred to a persecution against a probably Jewish sect in Rome called Christians. Because the text of Tacitus does not actually say Christians, but Christians. Now, that theory was actually brought up in the 1800s, forms of it at least, by Schiller and others. But for what it's worth, he views Tacitus as originally referring to a Jewish sect, and he also says something very notable in that Tacitus refers to this sect as if it no longer exists in his own time, which is 120 AD. He uses the past tense when he says that the public called them Christians, vulgus Christianos appellabat. Bottom line, taking all this together, the writings of Tacitus do not support any persecution of Christians by Nero or any substantive law or legal action taken against them, so strike them from the record. By the way, Tacitus says something else interesting in this passage, or I guess the fake Tacitus who forged it. He says that an immense multitude, multitudo ingens, was arrested in this anti-Christian Interpol crackdown. Now, it goes without saying, there was not an immense multitude of Christians in Rome in 64 AD. Pretty much everyone recognizes that, even those who believe in the conventional narrative. But when you ask theologians why Tacitus said this, what do they say but Tacitus was exaggerating for dramatic effect? Of course he was. Why is it that every single time there is something obviously questionable in these writings, and not just these, the Gospels, the letters of the New Testament, every time that anything weird or inconsistent shows up, it's always that part of it that's exaggerated or embellished. Like Jesus walking on the water was embellished, but he most probably indeed had a ministry near the Sea of Galilee where the water was that he supposedly walked on. Tacitus embellished the fact that an immense multitude of Christians were living in Rome, but nonetheless, there very much indeed was a persecution of Christians at the time. It's like, why can't that be the made up or embellished part? It's always the part that doesn't fundamentally threaten the traditional narrative of Christian origins that we have to concede as an invention. Something to consider. Now, lastly, we unfortunately have to talk now about Suetonius, The Lives of the 12 Caesars, written in the early 2nd century, biographies of the first few Roman emperors. It appears to mention Christians once. It lists some positive laws that were passed by Nero during his reign, and in that list is included the following. Punishment was inflicted on the Christians, a class of men given to a new and mischievous superstition. Now, as it turns out, Suetonius, Tacitus, and Pliny all use the exact same word to describe Christianity, superstitio. Now, all three of these guys were friends, as we know from Pliny's other letters, and I guess we can say to a certainty that none of these three guys owned a thesaurus, or if they did, they just kept re-gifting it to one another over and over again without reading it. I'm just going to say point blank that this Suetonius line is an interpolation into the text by a Christian, or even possibly by a pagan. It's unattested until the year 1590, for Christ's sake. He sticks it in the same section where he talks about Nero renovating the building codes in Rome. Other than that, it has nothing to do with the surrounding context. It's the kind of thing that would be meaningless to a Roman reader. Either Christianity was an obscure sect at the time or it wasn't. If it was, we wouldn't expect it to be mentioned here, and all the more so because not only does Suetonius not intimate that Christians are still around in his own time, but he doesn't actually tie the Christians to the fire as Tacitus does. And this Suetonius passage has literary dependence on the Tacitus passage in multiple places, not just the term superstition, but other parallels within it, even though it's such a tiny passage. And that was pointed out by Stuart Waugh. In other words, it was added by someone who knew the forged Tacitus passage, but also recognized that the way that Suetonius had written about the great fire, he didn't leave enough room, didn't leave an in for the forger to interpolate something about how Christians were involved with it. Now, the theologian K.R. Bradley examined the writings of a later Christian, Orosius, who used Suetonius, and he found that if the line did exist in Suetonius, it had different wording than we see in our copies today, and a variant in the wording suggests that the passage was added by a scribe. Now, there is another supposed reference to Christians in Suetonius, but it's so ridiculous that I'm annoyed that I even have to mention it. It's something he says about Jews being expelled from Rome because they revolted at the instigation of a man named Crestus. I'm going to put a phone number across the bottom of the screen right now. Can we do that? Put up a number there. Call me if you figure out whatever the fuck this passage has to do with Christianity in the slightest. I don't care that Crestus sounds like Christos or Christ. It's just completely inadmissible. Now, as we talked about, Richard Carrier's theory was that the original passage in Tacitus was about a group called the Crestians, and he in fact tied them to these Jews mentioned in Suetonius, who revolted because they were whipped up by someone called Crestus. And frankly, that's a much better theory than the idea that this passage had anything to do with Christians. But I think my theory is more consistent with Occam's razor in that both passages were added by zealous Christian scribes. Bottom line, the writings of Suetonius don't support a persecution of Christians by Nero or any substantive law or legal action taken against them. So strike them from the record, and we have now turned these sources into gas and poured them into the stratosphere. In beginning our close reading of Pliny's letter, we're devoting time to investigating its legal basis. Doing so will end up being the main means of undermining its authenticity. The consensus today is that the reason that trials of Christians are taking place at all in Pliny's letter is because Christianity had been illegal since the time of Nero and a persecution associated with that time. And we've argued today that the legal actions against Christians in the time of Nero are nothing more than airy fictions. In reviewing our sources, we determined that the historicity of the persecutions by Nero was questionable at best. We continue our examination of the Pliny letter in our quest to demonstrate that, being a forgery as it is, it does not conflict with the view that Christianity originated in the second century. And we close by asking again whether it's in fact not possible at all to entertain any doubts as to the letter's legitimacy. In the name of Saint Candida, we again declare Pliny's letter to be late and spurious, though, as we'll discuss next time, Saint Candida, Candida Moss herself, of course, believes that the Pliny letter is genuine. Thank you for listening. This criticism is ended. Go in peace.
What other stories of mythology do you think of as historical reality?